We're going to be talking about the first two chapters of the book Creative Mind and Success. We have provided electronic copies to everyone, thanks to a practitioner who lives out, I guess, in Las Vegas. And the first two chapters are an inquiry into the truth and what life is. And for those of you, I assume that one of the reasons we sent this out in this format was that so you could read along with us. And they're quick reads. The first two chapters take up a little over one page. Mm-hmm. So it's not hard if you want to follow along. Now, aside from the fact that we just passed Reverend Martin Luther King's birthday, another tremendous spiritual being, we're about to pass the 126th birthday of Ernest Holmes. He was born on January 21st in 1887. And he was born in a small town called Lincoln, Maine, which is, I spent a lot of time looking at maps. It was kind of up near the Canadian border. And there are several biographies that were written about Holmes. I've got a few. But the one I started reading this week, and I'm having a hard time putting down, is this one, which is Ernest Holmes, His Life and Times. This was written by his brother, Fenwick, who was a Congregationalist minister for a while, and later became as great a metaphysician as his brother, Ernest. He was older by 4 years, by the way. So in that little town of Lincoln, Maine, the Holmes family had 8 children, and they were all boys. And Ernest was by far the youngest. And the thing that struck me as I was reading the book is I always thought that if you were out living in the boonies, that probably you weren't reading a lot of books and that you weren't well-educated necessarily. But that absolutely is not true for the Holmes family. They were all intellectually curious, and each in their own way was a scholar, and they'd probably all be Yale graduates today if they'd had the means to go there. So Ernest Holmes was named after a preacher named Ernest Shurtleff, who was kind of poetic in nature and was a friend of his mother's. So his father's name was William Nelson Holmes, and he came from Canada. But the interesting thing is that his family could be traced back to some aristocracy in England, and they came over to this country, of course, in the great state of Connecticut, which I'm also from. And according to this book, there's a town in Connecticut named after him. I did a lot of searching and couldn't find it. I'd never heard of it, and I couldn't find it, say, on MapQuest. So I don't know if it wasn't renamed or something. But anyhow, so they came over to Connecticut. And he came from a large family himself, and when he was 14, he ran away. He was by far the most intellectually gifted among his siblings. He ended up settling in Maine, where he met a woman named Anna Columbia Heath. And her family came over in the early 17th century, perhaps in the Mayflower. And for those of you who may be Mayflower descendants, you may have known her. You know, it's amazing. Our ancestors may have known one another. So her own father died before she was born. Apparently, he went out west on a gold rush, and it probably was murdered. They never figured that one out. So she was raised by relatives while her mother continued to run a mill, and she actually received a formal education, which was unusual at the time, and she did work as a teacher for a while. And you'll see later on as I talk how important that was to Ernest Holmes and his brothers. She was herself intellectually brilliant and creative, enormously creative, and so was his dad. And she was tremendously organized as well. The two of them, Anna and William, had a very long and loving relationship. They were devoted to one another. And I didn't read anything about them disagreeing except early on in their courtship. Apparently they had a disagreement about whether or not you should rotate crops. So like I said, the kids were all eight children. There were actually nine children altogether, and one died young. They were born in Lincoln, Maine, and I looked in the map, and it's up near the Canadian border, and it's up above Bangor, which is like one of the last big cities north in this country. Whoops. So I'm glad you brought up sustainable living, because they lived a sustainable life. We call it homesteading, perhaps. They lived out in a farm. They raised all their own food. She made her own rugs. She made all their own clothes. They had sheep, so that she took the wool from the sheep. She spun it. She was constantly knitting. And she and I would have been great friends, I'm sure. But there was a part of her that also, you know, after everybody gone to bed, she sat up at night and she would talk to the stars. And so she had this enormous consciousness. Her husband was always up at about 3:30 in the morning, if you can imagine that. And he'd work like a 16-hour day out in the fields or in the barn. And she worked constantly as well. They had to work hard to support somehow their family, all the food and the shelter needs. So his dad often had to travel to find work. It was, one year they got wiped out with their sheep, and so they ended up having to move. You know, a lot of things like that would happen that would just totally wipe out a family, and they'd have to move on. And so his father did have to, he had to relocate to move, the family ended up moving to Bethel, Maine, which is it's one of the oldest towns in Maine. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but it's kind of near the northern part of New Hampshire. That was where Ernest received all of his scholastic education, and they attended the Congregationalist Church there. And that's really important, because Congregationalism was one of the more liberal of the Christian faiths, as opposed to, say, Baptist or Methodist. And Anna firmly believed that there was no devil and there was no hell. And so the religious fear that some churches would preach to their congregation was not part of his upbringing, not part of his consciousness. And so at night, the family would pray. And this gave all the kids the assurance that all was well in the world before they went to bed. And both parents were theologically liberal. They did a lot of home study of some metaphysical materials. And Ernest was not a pious child. He wasn't into going to church so much, but he was enormously curious. And he'd ask a lot of questions as his mother read the Bible. Ernest also had an early love of poetry, and his mother trained them in public speaking, which again was really important. You think about his mother, you know, they lived out in the middle of the woods or in a small town, and she did so much teaching for those kids. And as you know more and more about Ernest Holmes and our philosophy, you realize how much the parents of Ernest Holmes contributed to what we have today. So the book that we're reading, which is the Creative Mind and Success, was actually probably a second book. The first book was Creative Mind, which is the one that David had sent out. And the second one is Creative Mind and Success. The original version of Creative Mind and Success was published in 1919, so it's nearly 100 years old. And this is the one we have here is actually the sixth edition. It was published in 1926, the same year as the first edition of the Science of Mind textbook. And that's really important, because that Science of Mind textbook is kind of unexpurgated Holmes. It's how he really thought. And so what you're reading is really fresh material. And I think the more you dig into this as you read along with us in the chapters, the more you'll see how fresh these ideas are. So also, if you're looking to buy buy another copy of the book, the Kindle edition is the first edition. Yes, and I didn't, sorry to say, I did not spend any time trying to do side-by-side comparisons, seeing what the differences are. Excuse me, I'm having technical challenges with my Kindle.
I will be sending out the paragraphs that we're studying with the announcement for each of the study group meetings, so you should have it if you're on notice.
This particular book is what we call a guide to mental wellness and success. And there are basically two parts to this book. The first one is a lot of theory, and the second part is a little more practical application. So we're going to be giving you some theory for a while, and if you bear with us, I think it'll help you to really get this book. This is one of the first religious science books that I read willingly. And the reason I say that is because I read the textbook, and the textbook was a little tough for me to really get into. I just couldn't sit down and read it. But this book, there was something about it. It's short, but I could relate to it really well. The first two chapters are a little bit on the obscure side. It's Phil Holmes at his most theoretical. Mm-hmm. And what he's doing in these first two chapters is answering the question, what is life? So I'm going to, this is a little bit of preaching, what science of mind teaches. It teaches that life is the animating principle of being, and it's that inner something that makes everybody live. Life and power are necessary attributes of a limitless being, and they go hand in hand to complete a perfect being. Life is that which lives, and power is the energy with which it operates. Life and power are the sources of everything that exists. And that comes from, there's like a glossary at the back of the Science of Mind textbook that's got a lot of terms that are used over and over again in his books, and that comes from that definition. So he talks about different levels of consciousness, and in the mineral world we have all these things like this table and rocks and this basket here that we take the offering in. And it seems to be inert and unconscious, but some kind of chemical action was necessary to take place for this item to exist. And in the plant world, it manifests as something that stands in one place, like a tree or like a wheat field. And there are various, and then you move on to the animal world, and there are various degrees of manifestation from a little one-celled creature that scoots around like bacteria, or a human being, or whatever follows us in this scale of evolution. So life does manifest on several levels. The first, the inert objects are operating in what we call unconscious life, and we have in the animal we have what Holmes would call simple consciousness, and man has the opportunity to go through a higher level of consciousness up to cosmic consciousness, in which we have an appreciation that there's only one in the universe, and that one thing is life or God. As you read Holmes, you'll see that he uses various names for God, and life is one of them. So life is basically all there is. Now, I have a hard time with this idea that a mineral is like in an unconscious state, because I don't know about you, but if you touch a rock or something like that, you do get energy, a sense of something flowing through it to you. And each object does have some kind of consciousness if you are able to get it, to touch it and to feel it. And after living with cats and dogs for many years, I can tell you that while my dog doesn't speak or my cat doesn't speak in human terms, they do talk, they do communicate. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think my animals are a lot smarter than I am in a lot of ways, which is why I keep them around. So then these are all you think about it, these different levels of consciousness, whether or not you're going to call a rock unconscious or fully conscious, it doesn't matter. But they're all the different ways that God operates through us and as us. And so then life is that quality of being running through all, which enables anything to be what it is. And so, You know, the basic message of the first two chapters is life is God, you are life, and so it is. And I'm going to close here with a quote from Holmes. I'm believe it or not, Holmes has a Facebook page, and he continues to spout out. Why not? Yes, yeah, so here's something I got a couple days ago that I just loved. So close your eyes for a minute. And just breathe out. I accept the fullness of my own divine wellness. Within myself is that which is perfect, that which is complete, that which is divine, that which was never born and cannot die, that which lives, which is God, the eternal reality. Within myself is peace, poise, power, wholeness, and happiness. All the power that there is, and all the presence that there is, and all the life that there is God, the living spirit almighty. And this divine and living spirit is within me. It is wholeness. It is never weary, and it is never tired. It is life. It is complete peace. It is never afraid. It is never confused. It's always poised and peaceful. It is always in a state of perfect equilibrium. This is the truth about myself. There is no other self. Every image of fear is erased from my mind. Every sense of confusion leaves my thought. My mind now entertains and reflects the divine into everything which I do, say, and think, into my body, into my affairs. That divine within me is wholeness, and my mind reflects this wholeness into every organ, every function, every action, every reaction of my physical being, renewing it after the perfect pattern, the Christ within me. Universal substance reflects itself into my mind, into daily supply, so that everything I need every day is supplied. Before the need is the thing, and with the apparent need it is met. There is something within me which goes before me and prepares the way wherever I go, making straight the way, making perfect the way, making immediate and instant and permanent and harmonious every situation. Consequently, my mind reflects the fullness of that divine substance which heals every sense of lack in my life. Peace, poise, power, perfection, living spirit within me is me, myself, and I accept the fullness of my own divine well-being. And so it is.
So it is. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Hey!
Question, Judy?